scrolling for June 17th, 2020. I'm Steve Boder.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We're back again with another tale of Sherlock Holmes and Watson. This time it's March in this story. They very specifically give, for some reason, Doyle very specifically gives a date of March 16th on this one, but it seems like summer vacation time for Holmes and Watson. This is The Adventure of the Devil's Foot.
Spring love, Steve. Spring love.
Well, and it's interesting because the opening of this is a little odd. We've got in recording from time to time some of the curious experiences and interesting recollections which I associate with my long and intimate friendship with Mr. Sherlock Holmes. I have continually been faced by difficulties caused by his own aversion to publicity. To his somber and cynical spirit, all popular applause was always abhorrent, and nothing amused him more at the end of a successful case than to hand over the actual exposure to some orthodox official and to listen with a mocking smile to the general chorus of misplaced congratulation. Now, we have seen that sometimes where he's like, oh, don't tell anyone I was involved. You guys take the credit, Scotland Yard. But I don't know if he has a total aversion to publicity.
Right.
Constantly telling Watson, put this in your notes, write it down. I mean, that's how yesterday's story ended.
I'm going to just throw it right out there. He didn't want this written because he'll become an accomplice at this some point. Letting this guy off.
And that quote about the orthodox official is incorrect, too. They don't always hand off the case to some orthodox official. So this is...
Sometimes they're Catholic, right?
Is this Doyle saying the opposite of what he means, or is this Doyle trying to say Watson sees Sherlock as doing these things, but
is
we
this Watson
know
right?
Different.
Is this Watson being a little bit unreliable?
Okay, I buy that.
We've known from many of Sherlock Holmes' quotes in the past of what he really thinks of Watson.
Yes, we do. And we see a lot of that in this story, sir.
Now, there is a little bit of a mystery for the reader that I don't think we ever really solve. So Holmes telegrams Watson years later to say he should publish The Cornish Horror, this story. And Watson doesn't know why Holmes suddenly wants this published, and neither do we.
Do we? We'll find out when we get to the end, Pam. Maybe we do. Maybe this is just verisimilitude. Maybe this is just Doyle understanding how much the public understands this character as a real person. And this adds a little more of that element of reality. Maybe there's another reason that we'll get to at the end.
All right. Sounds good. Now, we start the story with Holmes very overworked and ill. So it was in the spring of the year 1897 that Holmes's iron constitution showed some symptoms of giving way in the face of constant hard work of a most exacting kind, aggravated perhaps by occasional indiscretions of his own. I don't know what those occasional indiscretions are, but anyway, in March of that year, Dr. Moore Agar of Harley Street, whose dramatic introduction to Holmes I may someday recount, he doesn't, gave positive injunctions that the famous private agent lay aside all his cases and surrender himself to complete rest if he wished to avert an absolute breakdown. The state of his health was not a matter in which he himself took a faintest interest, for his mental detachment was absolute, but he was induced at last, on the threat of being permanently disqualified from work, to give himself a complete change of scene and air. So we find out here that Holmes doesn't really care much about his health, but if it's going to affect his work, okay, then he's going to take it seriously.
And I think we've all gotten to this point. I'm in Los Angeles, California, because we were tired of being in the house. We were certainly in need of a change of scenery. And I think that that's what a vacation is taking that hard work that you've done and going, I need a rest. And the best way to rest is for me to remove myself from my normal environment.
And there's a lot of research that actually supports that. Yep. That ability to get away basically breaks you from routines. And ultimately, it will, if you allow it to, it will set you up on, what is important will rise, and you can let go of all the things that are, potentially holding you back or weighing you down.
Daily podcasting.
Sherlock Holmes is weighing you down, Steve. Well, spring is in the air, Steve. There's love out there.
We see that the Cornish landscape is very reminiscent of the moors of Baskerville Hall, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And it's funny because when Holmes has to take a vacation, take a rest, there's no question that Watson is going with him, right? So they head off together to a little cottage on the Cornish Peninsula, which, as you just said, looks a ton like the moors of near Baskerville Hall. And including that interest in the past, like the moors are kind of a key into England's past. It was a country of rolling moors, lonely and dun-colored, with an occasional church tower to mark the site of some old-world village. In every direction upon these moors, there were traces of some vanished race, which had passed utterly away and left as its sole record strange monuments of stone, irregular mounds which contained the burned ashes of the dead, and curious earthworks which hinted at prehistoric strife. The glamour and mystery of the place, with its sinister atmosphere of forgotten nations, appealed to the imagination of my friend, and he spent much of his time in long walks and solitary meditations upon the moor. You notice a lot of similarities, right, with
Right,
Baskerville?
that nod to the prehistoric, those symbols that a mind like Doyle's or Sherlock's would find intriguing. What was the story? Where's the story of these people? And here it is written in the landscape. I love that.
And it just secures Britain as a timeless type of place, maybe, with rich history. So much more than just the current history, the modern world.
And when they're out on these moors, Holmes becomes fascinated by Cornish philology, a branch of linguistics. And he really starts to study not only the landscape, but also the language that goes with this history. And of course, that reminds me, the most famous philologist I know is, of course, J.R.R. Tolkien, whose interest in philology was a huge part of his thought process in creating Middle Earth and writing the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And
A
so,
lot of hiking in that movie, in that
yes,
book.
indeed.
Lots of hiking.
Just a lot of walking. Even the trees walked in that movie.
A lot of walking, but also just a lot of interest in how ideas, thoughts, histories get translated in words.
Lots of songs.
Second breakfast. This mystery, boy, oh boy, is this an interesting mystery that caught my attention from the beginning.
Well, so Mortimer Treganus, and I will let you know that last night when I was reading this to my kids, my oldest was like, "Oh, Mortimer. Anyone named Mortimer is always the murderer."
They're quite judgmental, those kids.
Those meddling kids.
Strangely not wrong, despite like how weird that judgment. Anyway, Mortimer, the murderer, Treganus, left his sister and two brothers last night sitting around a table playing cards. The next morning, when he goes back, they're still at the table, and the two brothers are driven clean mad with terror, and Brenda lying dead of fright. It's a super weird scene, right?
Well, they're playing the devil's game, cards.
Yes, they're playing Whist. Of
Yeah.
all the non-demonic card games, Whist has got to be the
This is
game.
quite a scene, quite an engaging mystery here. I was really intrigued, and I was really looking forward to the resolution. And the resolution pays off pretty well by the end here, too. Mortimer consulted a vicar because he's staying at the vicarage, and so he goes to the vicar before coming to Holmes because this looks like it could be a supernatural sort of explanation for these deaths and this incredible sense of madness of the brothers.
Well, and I love Holmes's response to that. "I fear," said Holmes, "that if the matter is beyond humanity, it is certainly beyond me. Yet we must exhaust all natural explanations before we fall back upon such a theory as this." So Holmes isn't buying the supernatural explanation at all.
Mm-hmm. He didn't fall for it in Baskerville either.
Nope.
But death seems to follow him around. What's going on?
We do have some more supernatural things coming in the last few stories. And it's always rational. But I think
zoinks!
There's some great writing here in the description of the dementia, right? When Mortimer and the vicar bring the story, it's pretty intense. But then when Watson and Holmes are walking by and they see the demented brothers in a carriage, Watson's own description is very powerful. "As it drove by us," the carriage, "I caught a glimpse through the closed window of a horribly contorted, grinning face glaring out at us. Those staring eyes and gnashing teeth flashed past us like a dreadful vision." And so I think
that's ready for Halloween right there.
Right? Absolutely.
The idea of dementia, the idea of losing one's mind, is terrifying to me. I know people who have lost their mind and they're not the person that they were. And this vision of these horrible, again, contorted, back to that word that Doyle really enjoys.
Yes, he does.
But the grinning face, the contorted grinning face, that's quite the contrast and terrifying.
It is cruel, too. It's not just, it's not just... You know, to lose one's mind is a cruel. It's just, the alternative cruelness is to lose the control of your body but keep your mind. Yeah. So both of those are a cruel way, a cruel fate. Mm.
So we get the story from Mortimer here that there was a money trail. Holmes says, "I take it you were divided in some way from your family since they lived together and you had rooms apart." Mortimer replies, "That is so, Mr. Holmes, though the matter is past and done with. We were a family of tin miners at Redruth, but we sold our venture to a company and so retired with enough to keep us. I won't deny that there was some feeling about the division of the money and it stood between us for a time, but it was all forgiven and forgotten and we were the best of friends together."
And we all live together. That's right. We have all this. We sold the mine, but we're all living together.
Except for Mortimer, who's living at the vicarage.
Yeah.
I raised an eyebrow almost immediately at that point.
Yes. Absolutely. And, you know, we haven't followed the money in a little while. But remember, in the earlier stories, we had to follow the money all the time. So. Mm-hmm.
It's a trope.
We get the most unusual character that we have read about in any of these stories, I think. Dr. Leon Sterndale, the great lion hunter and explorer, enters Holmes and Watson's cottage.
And we should go ahead and just say that he looks a lot like Joe Exotic, just so you know.
I think that he conjures more of Hagrid in my mind.
Yes.
But I like, just think of it as Joe Exotic. It makes a lot of sense.
Go with that then. The huge body, the craggy and deep-seamed face with the fierce eyes and hawk-like nose, the grizzled hair which nearly brushed our cottage ceiling, the beard, golden at the fringes and white near the lips, save for the nicotine stain from his perpetual cigar, all these were as well known in London as in Africa and could only be associated with the tremendous personality of Dr. Leon Sterndale.
That's a lot of personality in that body.
Yes, that's a lot of body in that cottage. His hair nearly brushed the ceiling of the cottage.
Giant.
Maybe he's Grizzly Adams or a Sasquatch. I mean, he is massive.
Yeah. Yes. He says that he is a cousin of the family. which is very interesting that he is related to this matter by blood, he says.
And he was scheduled to leave to return to Africa when he was recalled by a telegram. And it's interesting because when Holmes is like, oh, who sent the telegram? He kind of bristles, right? He's like, you're asking a lot of questions, but then he does answer.
he says, a lot of questions. And Sherlock Holmes goes, yeah, I'm Sherlock Holmes.
I'm a kid. That's my job.
And then Holmes finds it pretty suspicious that he actually allowed some of his baggage to go on to Africa and he's going to catch a later boat. This isn't like catching a later train, like, 2 hours later in the afternoon. This is like a boat to Africa. So,
well, as we learned, there's some foreshadowing right there.
Yeah. This is definitely one of the big clues. Remember, there's family money at stake. So if he says he's a part of the family, then that follow the money is right there again.
Oh, my goodness.
He leaves and Holmes follows him for some amount of time. And he comes back and reports that Dr. Sterndale's account is confirmed. The hotel says he has actually allowed some of his baggage to go on to Africa while he returned to be present at this investigation. What do you think of that, Watson? Says Sherlock. Watson replies, he is deeply interested. And Sherlock confirms, yes, deeply interested. Dun, dun, dun. There's a second death in this mystery. I don't know that we had... Are there many stories where we had a second death after the first investigation has started?
No. I think this is fairly unusual. And the death of Mr. Mortar Tregaines, who we've met, is a bit unusual as well.
Mm-hmm. The vicar arrives early the next morning and tells Sherlock and Watson that Mortimer Tregaines died during the night with exactly the same symptoms as the rest of his family. Our visitor was so excited that he could hardly articulate, but at last, in gasps and bursts, his tragic story came out of him. This was a good mystery. I was like, okay, that might be suspicious. The vicar might be the one who's suspicious now, because how did this happen? Why did this happen? Holmes, Watson, and the vicar rush to the scene. Let me describe exactly the scene as we saw it upon that misty March morning. That's good alliteration, Doyle. Good. It has left an impression which can never be effaced from my mind. Doyle is a good writer, you guys. We should really read more of these stories.
Steve, I think we're going to read them all. Something tells me COVID-19 is not going away.
I thought that we fixed that already. We have such a short attention span, don't we? Like, hey, look over there. Don't forget about COVID. Oh, yeah, that. The atmosphere of the room was of a horrible and depressing stuffiness. The servant who had first entered had thrown up the window, or it would have been even more intolerable, and a lamp stood flaring and smoking on the center table. I had my suspicions with the first suspicious death that the fire was a part of this, and here we have a lamp flaring and smoking in the center table, and so my suspicions became even more justified. Sherlock certainly gets his energy back here. He's not quite as ill as he was that forced this vacation, right?
Right. He always does. And that's the thing about Sherlock, is that having a mystery seems to be, you know, way more constitutionally helpful to him than taking a break. So one realized the red-hot energy which underlay Holmes's phlegmatic exterior when one saw the sudden change which came over him from the moment that he entered the fatal apartment. In an instant, he was tense and alert, his eyes shining, his face set, his limbs quivering with eager activity. He was out on the lawn, in through the window, round the room, and up into the bedroom for all the world like a dashing foxhound drawing a cover. And this reminds me of Mycroft, right? Saying, listen, I'm super smart, but I'm not going to go around, you know, like interviewing train conductors and laying on the floor. looking at things through a lens. That's what Holmes loves to do, right? He's running in the bedroom. He made a rapid cast around, ended by throwing open the window, which appeared to give him some fresh cause for excitement, for he leaned out of it with loud ejaculations of interest and delight. Then he rushed down the stair, out through the open window, threw himself upon his face on the lawn, sprang up and into the room once more, all with the energy of the hunter who is at the very heels of his quarry. This is great. I mean, he is like that dashing foxhound again, and running all over the place, finding clues, getting super excited.
This is the most energetic we have seen him in his activity. This is the Ace Ventura pet detective investigation style, especially the threw himself upon his face on the lawn line. I was like, what is he doing? And Watson is completely flummoxed by this.
And if you think of it more like a bloodhound, I mean, he's a dog. He's just doing it.
But Steve, do you think Watson is flummoxed, or do you think Watson is happy to see like Sherlock is back?
I think it's a combination. I think he's
flummoxed. Okay, I buy that.
What is Sherlock doing? Why is Sherlock running around like this right now? But at the same time, yes, my friend is finally well. My friend is finally energized. I love my friend who is now running around like a crazy person.
Right. And like a guy who's about to solve a mystery, right? Mm-hmm. You know he's on to something at this moment. Now, from there, and you know, it's fun to talk about what Watson might be feeling. Of course, he doesn't tell us, so we can read it however we want. From there, I think we go into one of the best, what people might call John Locke moments that we've had so far. And it's funny because, as you guys know, I'm reading this with my daughters who are 9 and 11 and who are really, really into shipping characters. And so the ship name for John Watson and Sherlock Holmes is John Locke. So for them, they were like, "Ooh, it's a John Locke moment." They're really excited. They love the idea that Sherlock and Watson have some sort of homoerotic relationship, which is, as we've talked about many times on this podcast, a very, very common fan reaction. And so when we get to this moment, Sherlock sees the flakes of powder that are on the smoke guard of the lamp. You guys have already, we know that that lamp is important. He takes half of the powder. And when Watson asks him why, he says he's leaving the other half for the police in case they're smart enough to figure it out. So at that moment, we already know that Sherlock is not going to be turning over his solution to the mystery. He's not going to turn that over to the police, right? He's leaving them half the clue in case they get it, which we all know they won't.
So he's now tampering with evidence.
Correct.
Yes. At a murder scene. Yeah.
At a murder investigation. Yeah. Murder two in 2 days.
Yeah. Which is now in his possession. Uh-huh. So, oh my God.
But you guys, he doesn't just tamper with the evidence, right? He sets up an experiment for himself and Watson.
This is crazy.
This reminds me of something I saw yesterday about COVID, which was like, would an institutional review board, anytime you do an experiment involving human subjects, you have to get permission from your institutional review board. Would an IRB give permission to reopen schools in September if you were giving them your experimental log? I'll tell you, I don't know about that, but an IRB would not give permission for the experiment which Sherlock and Watson are about to undertake. So he says, listen, I think this is the poison. You and I will sit across a table from each other, watch each other closely, and we'll see if it works on us. We'll see if it makes us go crazy, demented, and or die. All right? You in? Yeah, we're in. Let's do this.
So let's just throw this out. We got two dead guys sitting around. They're like, oh, there was two murders. Now there's four deaths. Who are those guys sitting over there?
So we've got the two demented people and the two dead people. And honestly, like, which is worse? I mean, I don't think those dement guys are coming back, right?
No.
It doesn't look good. So, all right. The poison, it turns out, works very quickly. And here's what Watson tells us. The turmoil within my brain was such that something must surely snap. I tried to scream and was vaguely aware of some hoarse croak, which was my own voice, but distant and detached from myself. At the same moment, in some effort of escape, I broke through that cloud of despair and had a glimpse of Holmes's face, white, rigid, and drawn with horror, the very look which I had seen upon the features of the dead. It was that vision which gave me an instant of sanity and of strength. I dashed from my chair, threw my arms around Holmes, and together we lurched through the door, and an instant afterwards had thrown ourselves down upon the grass plot and were lying side by side, conscious only of the glorious sunshine which was bursting its way through the hellish cloud of terror which had girt us in.
People should... I don't get it, Pam.
No, not yet. So that moment, so what happens is that like they were super close to death. This is the closest we've seen them to death, right?
Because
they were going to die together, Pam. They were going to
I know. And then just as he's about to go absolutely insane, Watson sees Holmes's face and is like, I have to save him. And that's what gives him the strength to save them both, right? But then that's not the shipping moment, my dear. Holmes seemed stunned, and then, upon my word, Watson, said Holmes at last with an unsteady voice, I owe you both my thanks and an apology. It was an unjustifiable experiment, even for oneself, and doubly so for a friend. I am really very sorry. You know, I answered with some emotion, for I have never seen so much of Holmes's heart before, that it is my greatest joy and privilege to help you. Okay, come on, you guys.
Cue the romantic music. Right? The orchestra just is going to get louder at this moment.
He has never seen so much of Holmes' heart before. Neither have we, my friends. Neither
have we. Because he apologized for almost killing them? That's the heart moment?
Steve, that's real love, when you can almost kill each other.
When you know that there's poison and you decide to test it on yourself and your friend, and then afterwards you go, huh, I'm sorry.
And Watson, as a doctor, says, yeah, okay, this sounds great. Let's do this. Let's go with this. He goes, well, if you love me, we could do this.
He doesn't all say, right. Let's do this. He says, it is my greatest joy and privilege to help you.
Oh, my God. I don't think Watson's going to keep his medical license.
Does he still have it at this point?
He's Holmes's companion.
It's kind of like asking whether or not Homer Simpson still works at the nuclear plant. I don't know. He never goes there. I don't know. Is he still a doctor? We find out that this mystical powder is the devil's foot. We find this out from Sterndale, who brought this mystical power to Mortimer because he was the one who asked for it. This is weird.
Well, Steve, it's hidden. Only a few people know about this.
And it's amazing how very quickly this powder has affected Holmes and Watson, and therefore how quickly it affected its other two victims in the story.
And to defend this a little bit, think of the rainforest. Not where this is from, but just how many medicines come from nature, some exotic area where we really don't have, all of a sudden they learn, oh, if you use this leaf or whatever it is.
Christmas tree bark.
Yeah. Christmas tree bark. Anyway, it ends up creating some desired effect.
Well, and I think it's really important what you just said there, Chip, that this is exotic. Right? So this is once again, Doyle bringing in something from an exotic land, somewhere in Africa, not very specific, that was more powerful than anything that you could grow here in England. And we've seen that before, especially with the earlier stories, when we had, like exotic snakes or, other creatures that came from India or Africa. Just this notion that the world is a big place. We're learning more and more all the time. Sterndale is a scientist bringing all of these incredible things to the continent. There's an interest here in globalization that's, I think, both optimistic and pessimistic at the same time.
And that very much is Britain at the time, right? The mm-hmm. sun never sets on the British Empire.
The colonial. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Sterndale avenged the death of Brenda Tregennis by killing Mortimer.
I have avenged you!
And this is when we find out that he has been in love with Brenda for many years, and he can't get a divorce from his estranged English wife. Now, we've seen this critique of divorce laws before, right? Mm-hmm. But usually we've seen it from the woman's side, where she can't get away from an abusive husband.
Henry VIII. Or Henry VI.
In the home stories.
We're talking about in the home stories.
In history.
I've just lost my head over that. I'm sorry.
So it's interesting when Sterndale describes the killing of Mortimer. Because, come on, this is a horrible way to die, right? Mm-hmm. He says he sees him start to convulse and be impacted by the poison. But he says, my heart was flint, for he endured nothing which my innocent darling had not felt before him. There is my story, Mr. Holmes. Perhaps if you loved a woman, you would have done as much yourself. As we know, when faced with true love, Watson and Holmes let Sterndale go. They always do. You can get away with murder if you did it for the right reasons.
Right.
You're going back to Africa, right? It's not like he's going to be hanging out on the Cornish moors. He's heading straight back in the next boat. His luggage is already there. They let him go. But it's interesting for him, who's only met Holmes like one time for like, you know, 15-minute interrogation 2 days earlier. Perhaps if you loved a woman, you would have done as much yourself. How does he know anything about Sherlock's complex relationship with the fairer sex?
Well, he must have looked at how Sherlock looks at Watson and Watson looks at Sherlock. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there.
It seems like that's how I read it too.
This idea of like
a joke, but I was like, well, I'm serious.
You're probably right. You're probably right. He read the situation. He's a manly man, and he is very observant.
He's a lion tamer.
And he kills for love. I mean, what can you say?
Right?
Sardine oil.
He looks like Hagrid.
Which brings us to the ending. Which is just like the final paragraph is a long analysis by Holmes. I have never loved Watson, but if I did, and if the woman I loved had met such an end, I might act even as our lawless lion hunter has done. Who knows? Well, Watson, I will not offend your intelligence by explaining what is obvious. And then he kind of does explain a few things. And then he says, and now, my dear Watson, I think we may dismiss the matter from our mind and go back with a clear conscience to the study of those Chaldean roots, which are surely to be traced in the Cornish branch of the great Celtic speech. The end. Time to do some philology, folks.
Oh, my God. there's a little death. Don't worry about that. Yeah, we're going to dismiss this matter. Oh, my God. With a clear conscience. Only a couple deaths.
Yeah, it's fine. What's the problem? He avenged. There was justification for this murder. I mean, it was just a little murder.
I don't know. Would his peers feel that was justified? Good Lord.
Well, guys, I mean, listen, I'm not trying to, but I mean, he did kill the murderer who killed his sister and drove his brother's insane. So, I mean, I'm not.
Crime of passion.
Not justifying murder, but I mean, Mortimer did it first. And Mortimer.
Oh, that works out real well. All right. But he did it first. Jury. Look at it. He did it first.
When my students get yelled at for talking and they go, but he was talking too, that is not justification for me not yelling at you for talking.
All right, thanks for comparing murdering your entire family to middle school hijinks, but... So it's so funny, though, because there's a certain code of ethics here, right? And honestly, obviously, I'm not... I feel like I have to say, I'm not saying it's okay, but I mean, Sterndale, I think, feels especially upset because there's got to be a little guilt there. Why was he talking about this famous devil's foot to Mortimer in the first place, right? Like, he provided totally, you know, unintentionally, he provided the tool for this guy to kill his beloved. Mm-hmm. And he's got to be, you know, he feels really obviously upset by that because it's a horrible way to die, as we have found. And he ends up killing the killer. not cool. But as we've seen, I mean, two stories ago, sometimes the police look the other way at that too, in this turn of the century English mystery. So,
I'm going to just add one other part. Holmes has his Jedi mind trick, and he just forces everyone to go, well, you got all of this. Let me go ahead and fill in the rest of the details. That's pretty amazing that the other guy goes, well, you know, I'm going to go ahead and add some more to your story.
Yeah, there is that trope of the guy just admitting everything and throwing himself on the mercy of Sherlock Holmes, because Sherlock Holmes is very merciful and just lets people go all the time.
You've been sentenced to a ship out of the country.
Yeah, to go live out your life doing your life's work. You're welcome.
It would be kind of interesting, you guys, to make a spreadsheet of the endings of these stories.
Yes, Pam, you would love that.
Well, you would too, Steve. Don't even pretend. You know, you have as many spreadsheets as I do. You know, when I was working with dime novels some years ago, I did do an analysis of endings, how many people got punished and how many didn't. And, you know, how many people died at the end, were punished, were let go, etc. It does provide a kind of interesting view into, the sort of morality of detective tales. And as we are in number 43, I'm thinking it might be fun to do that with the Holmes stories, like for real.
Well, just on that, looking at the response of it, here in movies in the United States, we love happy endings. And yeah. So lots of movies, you know, a book may not have a happy ending, but the
adaptation.
Yes.
Yeah, they might make it into a happy ending because that would sell. Yeah.
So which of these stories are, of the endings, how many are similar? So do we like our Sherlock Holmes books ending with this type of ending where they're let off, or, you know, where revenge or whatever it is, goes to jail or whatever?
I smell another book in your future, Pam. I think you could write that book just like you did with the dime novel book. So, but we need to get back to the original question. You proposed a question at the beginning, Pam. Why did Holmes telegram Watson years later to say he should publish the Cornish Horror? Why was that included at the beginning of this tale?
I'll answer that. Statute of limitations. At that point, they could not charge him.
That's why Holmes sent a message to Watson to publish, because now it can become public? Interesting. Pam, what do you think?
I don't know. I really don't know. That is a mystery. What do you think?
I think that this is a mystery that Holmes is sending to Watson to explain to Watson, finally, his true feelings for Watson. I think that this is a love letter in the most Holmesian, mysterious way that it could possibly be explained to Watson. How about that?
I like that, Steve. And I like that from you, a skeptic of the John Locke relationship.
There's so much.
That works. Yeah, yeah.
The evidence is overwhelming at this point, isn't it?
It kind of is, yes.
So hopefully we get to the bottom of that mystery as we go through the rest of the canon, but we really want to hear from you. What do you think? What's going on in your life? How does this exploration go to your exploration of life? What's your favorite of these stories? We're going to wrap up his last bow in a couple of days here. So we'd love to hear from you. Tell us what your favorite of these tales is. I think maybe our list has changed in the last few days. We'll see what happens in the wrap-up episode. Give us a call or a text. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of that conversation from around the world. And go to our dedicated website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for all of these conversations. We get to the 44th short story tomorrow, His Last Bow, an epilogue of Sherlock Holmes. Is that the last story of The Last Bow?
It is.
Then we'll do our wrap-up after that. So we would love to hear from you. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Fedor.
Where's my sandwich?
talk about is what I want to thank you for, what I want.